Welcome to Root Words, a podcast that explores agriculture and cooking's role in connecting us to our landscape and our communities. I'm Stephen Abitel. Root Words is a collaboration between Vermont Farmers Food Center, Shrewsbury Agricultural Education and Arts Foundation, and many other community members. We're excited to introduce you to some passionate folks that are bringing communities together around food. So please pull up a chair and enjoy. Welcome back to our second episode in a five-part mini-series exploring how a focus on local food builds relationships with people and the environment. In our last episode, we explored the challenges that a global food system can have for local communities. On this episode of Root Words, we'll talk with Ken Meter, president of Crossroads Resource Center, and Philip Ackerman Lest, farmer, author, and Vermont Farmers Food Center board member, as we explore the concept of a community food web and the benefits of this local alternative. To start us off, let's go back to our conversation from the last episode with Ellen Kaler, executive director with Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund and member of the Governor's Commission on the Future of Vermont Agriculture, where she helped create Vermont Farm to Plate, the state's food systems development plan. Ellen says that the COVID-19 pandemic caused major disruptions in the fragile global food system.
Many of us were sounding the alarm for many, many, many years about the consolidation happening in the food system and the over-reliance on a small number of distributors, a small number of retail outlets, for instance, and that our food supply chain was at risk, that it was vulnerable to climate and, as we saw, health-related shocks, impacts of pandemics or of natural disasters, for instance. And many of us have been talking about it for a very long time, but it wasn't until the pandemic, especially those first few months, when we really all experienced what it meant when a supply chain breaks. We saw and felt what it meant when all of a sudden this very vulnerable, although highly efficient, system that has evolved over the last 50 years, when it breaks, it really breaks. You know, and food has to be grown, it has to be manufactured. It's not like you can just flip a switch when the electricity's working and you can just immediately have more food from someplace else. It doesn't work that way. It's a natural system. So I think the thing that gives me hope is that there were so many people that kind of woke up to the fact that we are vulnerable, especially if you take a look at some maps that were generated back in 2019 out of some research out of University of Chicago looking at what they call food flows. And you take a look at some of the maps and it really shows you visually how vulnerable we are in the Northeast, because we're really at the end of the supply chain. We're at the end of the distribution system. We're at the end of the trucking routes. You know, most of the food that enters this country from elsewhere comes through the port of Los Angeles. And then it gets distributed all the way across the country. It comes in from Mexico, from China, from Southeast Asia, wherever it's coming from. And it's coming from the California Central Valley primarily. And then it heads across the middle of the country. And as we know, a lot of grains and stuff are picked up in the middle of the country. And all of that flows into New York, Pennsylvania, up I-95, up to Maine, and it spurs up into Vermont and other parts of New England. And so literally, we're at the end of the supply chain. And so as a result, when something breaks in another part of the country, it's much more likely now that we're going to experience those breaks here in Vermont or in New England. So the opportunity, the hope that I have is that that wake-up call that has happened is actually leading people to think about opportunities that exist for expanding our regional food system. So I mentioned we're part of a six-state effort called New England Feeding New England, and we've set a goal of getting to 30% regional food production from regional consumption by 2030. So in Vermont, we're trying to get to 25% of local just in Vermont, and then we want to be part of this larger effort to get the 30% across the region, which is a really big deal because Vermont is so small comparatively. You know, we have 650,000 people and there's 15.1 million people across the six New England states. I mean, it's just an order of magnitude that's just so huge, right? And most of the eaters are in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And then, as I said earlier, most of the production happens in Vermont and Maine. And so the opportunity for us, for the producers in Vermont, is not only to supply more of the food that Vermonters are eating locally, but it's also to be able to sell into the New England markets. And the benefit of selling into New England markets is that Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut tend to have higher income earners than we have here in Vermont, which means that producers can sell at a higher price point without consumers batting an eye in the other states. So it can be a really great opportunity for our state level producers to sell a portion of what they grow or raise or produce here in Vermont at the price point that Vermonters are willing to pay, but then make additional margin and really increase their overall economic viability by selling a portion into the New England region. And that both and strategy, I think, has some real potential. And what we're seeing is that the food hubs, they're part of a New England and even a whole East Coast food hub collaborative where they're actively talking about this cross-docking and some shared warehousing space to be able to link up and really build out a more local and regionalized local food-oriented distribution system to supply our institutions with, whether that's colleges, universities, schools, hospitals, for instance, or selling into independently owned grocery stores in the region. And we in Vermont have over 100 independently owned grocery stores, including 13 or 14 food cooperatives. You know, and those are, again, very relationship-based opportunities where we know the owners, right? We have access to the people that own these stores or that are the general managers to these co-ops. So there's more of an opportunity to have even greater availability of local products in these more locally owned retail outlets and distributed by locally or regionally owned distributors. So it's not just, you know, localizing or regionalizing the food production, it's also all the way across the supply chain. We need to be strengthening our independently owned grocery stores and food co-ops. We need to be strengthening and supporting our local and regionally owned distributors, for instance. It's really about how do we link up the alternative supply chain, meaning the local and regional food supply chain. How do we strengthen that, invest in it, grow that, so it can actually meet more of the needs because the national system is just not going to be as values aligned as what our local and regional system is going to be, never will be.
Creating an alternative supply chain will need to be a community effort played out region by region. But communities don't need to feel isolated while doing this work. Food systems analysts like Ken Meter can help provide perspective. In 2019, Ken conducted and wrote VFFC's market study, which helped guide its strategic planning in 2020. Ken Meter is the president of Crossroads Resource Center, a nonprofit organization that works with communities to foster democracy and local self-determination. His local economic analyses have promoted local food networks in 140 regions, 40 states, 2 provinces, and 3 tribal nations. His recent book, Building Community Food Webs, is an inspiring collection of stories about how communities transformed their food systems and local economies.
Well, my work from Crossroads really comes out of the farm credit crisis of the 1980s and learning some economics about farming from farmers when I was working in a small community in Minnesota. And they gave me some insights into the economy that no one else had ever really mentioned in all my academic training or my practical professional experience. So that had really sort of shaped my work ever since. And that shows up in the book very visibly in terms of the analysis of the extractive economy and how the food system we've inherited is pretty good at taking wealth out of rural America and basically depositing that in metropolitan centers. And based on those understandings, I've done a lot of work with studying a local farm and food economy, helping local activists make an economic case for going to more local food production, and trying to consult with groups that are full of volunteer early professionals who are looking for strategic guidance and how to do that more effectively. I think a lot of cases my work is involved just simply doing an economic study and giving a speech to kind of motivate local folks to think more seriously about the potential for local food. But it's also gotten into regional food plans, statewide food plans, feasibility analysis like the one I did for the Vermont Farmers Food Center, and a wealth of other things where people have kind of brought their challenges to us and said, we'd like your help in sifting through how to best make some change in our food system with the resources we have. So it's been an incredible education to get around the country so many places. And I've been to Vermont several times, or to New England several times. But I've just learned so much from people on the ground about the issues they're facing and the courage they have in facing them with often limited political support and limited resources. It's really been exciting to be part of all those discussions around the country.
So what is, I suppose every community and every region is different, but what is the economic case for relocalization for maybe for a place like Rutland County?
Typically what I find is that people in really most communities are importing 90-95% of the food that they eat. And some communities I've studied are buying states are buying $10-15 billion worth of food a year. And when you think of 90% of, say, $15 billion leaving your state, that's a lot of money that is fleeing each state in the country. We have this kind of crazy food system where most farmers are exporting 85-90% of what they produce to ship abroad or to ship to industry, not really producing food for people. And most of the states, most communities I've worked with are importing 85-95% of their food. And so you have this kind of crazy system where people are shipping food long distances back and forth. And it ends up, farmers are selling at wholesale prices and consumers are buying at retail prices. And most of the difference between those prices goes out of the state or out of the community. So in a lot of ways, what I really try to motivate people with is to say, there's really hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, leaving your community every year. And you're not going to be able to replace all of that because your climate is limited and your number of farms is limited. But to the extent you can replace that with local production and get that food directly to local customers or process that food locally, you can build a lot more wealth and also more connections and more health for your communities. It's not simply an economic argument, but I like to focus on economics simply because for the most part, we've inherited a food system that we have because it makes sense economically, at least to some people. And my job has been to kind of highlight the fact that while it may work for some and it may be functioning for paying taxes and paying people's bills in their businesses, it's actually drawing wealth out of rural Vermont. It's drawing wealth out of communities like Rutland. And the only real way I can see for reversing that is to really get very comprehensive about building community-based food systems where you grow food, you process food, and you consume food in the same place so that the added value stays at home. The expertise for growing food and handling food safely stays at home. And consumers know and really decide to support the farmers who live near them. If I grow food in a farm in Rutland and someone comes to the Vermont Farmers Food Center Farmers Market and buys it there, or if it goes to a local processor, then every step of that way, someone in the local community is likely to be making an income. The more that we're hiring local labor, hiring local processors, committed to buying from our neighbors, the more money stays in the community. And that can cycle two or three times through the community if we're lucky, if we are very cogent about committing ourselves to local purchasing, if we're really committed to making sure that farmers get to set a price that works for them, that covers their cost of production and doesn't run them further and further into debt or into financial despair. The more we do that, the more money we retain in our communities, and that creates a stronger local economic multiplier. It also means that we have more to say over the health and welfare of our community. If we know how to raise the food we need and we're basically making money trading that with each other, then the changing winds internationally or nationally do not need to affect us as drastically as they do if we're really depending on shipments of food from far, far away.
So yeah, let's talk about food webs. I think a lot of people know about webs in nature, right? But what are food webs, and how is localization help build the community food webs?
Well, you know, I like the image of a food web, even though it's sort of a different than how academics usually talk about a food web in the environment. But I like it for community groups, partly because some community groups have just started calling themselves food webs, and I think that's I like to kind of amplify the work of local groups. So the first food web I heard about was 10 Rivers Food Web out in Oregon. The reason I like the term is that, you know, web is something that, you know, like you think about a spider web, it's something that has very fragile filaments, but when you put them all together, it has a lot of strength. And it's something that, you know, we can weave ourselves with the resources we've got and the skills we've got. And I like it for being an image of something we can kind of knit together on our own volition and our own resources. And to me, the term networks is almost as good, but it's a little bit more dry. And it doesn't have that same feeling of this is something we can build for ourselves. The idea of a food web is that you really need to get everybody playing. If we had a video, I would show a diagram of a food system, but it involves everything from farmers planting their fields to harvesting their crops to delivering their crops to a wholesaler or to a buyer. Often it goes to a processing plant. It may go through a distribution warehouse system for a while, goes through trucks all around the country these days, goes to restaurants, goes to colleges, goes to schools, which sometimes buy those foods. And then a lot of the waste from that system ends up being recycled back into compost and becoming new fertility for farms. And so I like to talk about the web because it's a more of a circular image to me of how we have to work, getting all those parties to work together and function together, of what people are starting to call now a virtuous cycle, where you have people reinforcing each other's efforts and helping each other out, and not simply isolated and individual businesses kind of fending for themselves. I think the other thing too is that I talk about community food webs, partly to distinguish it from ecology, but you know, this is really a matter of community building. And so in a lot of ways, the real successful food webs that I've interviewed and I've written about, the common element is that they've developed quite a bit of strong trust with each other to really know each other personally, know what each other needs, look out for each other as they try to meet their own self-interest, and not try to sort of win for the sake of losing over your neighbor. And that trust, I think, is very hard to come up with in American society right now, given the polarization we have and given the extreme mobility and individualism we're encountering in our country right now. So what I find is that people who step back and move slowly to build trust and build relationships that are nourishing of each other can often be the most effective in building these webs. It's not simply an economic process, but it should be an economic one. I like to think of a food web, a community food web, building health, wealth, connection, and capacity in communities such as Rutland, so that you're not only thinking about money, but you're also thinking about how well do we connect with each other? What sort of social networks do we form by the work we do? How do we build the capacity to really know how to handle food well? Growing food that's safe to eat, eating healthy food, preparing food in a safe way, handling food safely all the way through the value network. And having those skills is probably as important as anything, because when the economy shifts, if you have the skills, you can adjust and you can do something different to meet changing circumstances. Trust is also really important to that too, because as things change and we're in a very rapidly changing environment, if you have the trust, you can negotiate with your neighbor and say, well, what we did before is not going to work now. How do we change this in a way that we don't hurt each other? Those are sometimes very difficult conversations, but people have developed the trust and the connection around that are much better able to handle that than anyone else. I think the other thing I would emphasize is health. And I mean, I think we're a lot of us are eating foods, including myself, we're eating foods pretty routinely. They're not good for our bodies, and we're getting increasing sense of ill health from the foods we do eat. So we're not only spending a lot of money outside buying food, we're buying food that's not healthy. We're not eating in healthy ways. We're not getting enough exercise. There's a whole lot of things that need to be improved if we're going to have a healthy food system. And while I like to focus on economics, because that's one way of sort of dismantling the assumptions we have about the economy, it's also not simply an economic process. It's also about building health, using food as a vehicle for health, using good food at hospitals and so on, as prescribing fresh fruits and vegetables or what have you.
So, I think all communities are different, and all food systems are a bit different. But so the concept of a food hub, how does that fit into this conversation?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's something we wrestled with when we were working with the food hub in Rutland. My sense is that the concept of a food hub, as you'll see in the book, has really been oversold by the USDA. And a lot of communities have decided to do a food hub without really having the web in place that could support the hub. I think the food hub is a great thing for helping coordinate local conversations. I think one of the things the food hub can do really well is to provide a place where a farmer who has extra product can call someone up and say, I've got extra squash or whatever, and I'm looking for someone to buy it. Or someone who's looking, you know, a chef who's looking for buy something can call up someone and say, which farm can supply this to me? And I think that concept of coordinating the network in the community is a very valuable function a food hub plays. But it's also true that food hubs in general have been cost centers rather than profit centers. They tend to cost more to run and operate than we really can bring in from profitable operations. And a lot of groups I've worked with have really started food hubs thinking that they were going to be making money to keep their nonprofit alive, or making enough money to support themselves for year after year. And that does happen, but not very often. Most food hubs rely heavily upon foundations, some subsidies, or philanthropic donations, or donations from the community, or what have you. And that is fine. I mean, there's no reason not to run a food hub that doesn't rely heavily on contributions as well as earned income from sales or services that might be provided. But the point is that a lot of people get into building a facility or starting a hub before they really have the web of relationships that will support the activity. And I think one of the weird things we dance is I had a banker in South Carolina told me that as you make these changes from where we are now to where we're going, supply and demand have to balance at every step of the way. And that means you're often starting something small until, you know, creating a little bit of new supply until the demand catches up with you. And then you need a bigger building, and you have to build a bigger building, and you have to get the resources to do that. And then you try to balance supply and demand that size. And then you may have to get a bigger building if you're lucky. And those things are expensive. It takes kind of a flexibility to invest in a model that's going to change over time. It takes a lot of trust and a lot of philanthropic dollars to keep these things going. So I think the communities I know that have had the most difficulty have dived in thinking that we'll make money in a couple of years if we open a food hub. And I think as long as you understand that's a social enterprise that's going to depend on both sales revenue and also philanthropic donations. That's a very exciting business model, and it allows you to really shape the business in the way you want for local conditions based on local needs as you identify them. And it provides a really valuable role of coordinating the conversation and being a focal point where people can point to that and saying, here's what we're doing to build our local food system. But I think the other risk of a food hub is that you end up sort of trying to help the food hub itself survive rather than saying, this food hub is an element in a whole system we have to build, and that system has to be built on farms, in customers' households, in hospitals, in schools, in colleges, you know, in basically every corner of life in the community. And I like the term food web because it really talks about that network of relationships we want to build. And if the web is strong, it can support a food hub. If the web is not strong, the community may not be ready for a food hub.
Yeah, as you're saying this, I'm wondering, like, what is the most basic element of a food web? Is it enthusiasm?
Well, I mean, I think it's trust. I mean, enthusiasm is great. It's really important, but also it can merely mislead you. As I said before, I think trust is really the core of it, because if you have the relationships in place and people are working with each other without manipulating each other, without lying to each other, without kind of fighting each other, then you can negotiate these things. You can say, things are changing. How do we change? How do we adapt together and make things better? If you're overly enthusiastic, then you risk the possibility of selling yourself on something that you really can't afford, or you're running too far down a road that you're really not ready to handle. And enthusiasm is important, but it also can get you in trouble. Whereas trust very seldom gets you in trouble. I think trust can be problematic if you trust the wrong outsider, or if you believe you have trust that really isn't there. But if you have mutual trust and people are really honest and kind of transparent and steady with each other, then you can really ride through a lot of these things that are changing rapidly, and you can figure out where to go.
A community food web builds health, wealth, connection, and capacity within the local community. Ken believes that a community food web is largely a relational network, and that the strength of these relationships relies on trust. Philip Ackerman Lest is a farmer, former food systems professor, VFFC board member, and author of Rebuilding the Food Shed: How to Create Local, Sustainable, and Secure Food Systems. While working with partners in the food web, Philip puts his faith in trust. And just a quick note here, I connected with Philip in his barn for this interview, and you may hear some background crickets.
And I think trust is just it's relational, it's human. And I think ultimately it starts out with what my friend Dutchin from Bhutan calls the sincerity of intent. And when you start with the sincerity of intent and you build forward there, then I think that really is what provides the most authentic, genuine trust, that's possible. Why would all these people go to all of this, work and utilizing their spare time and finances, to help build out not just an organization, but a vision? Nobody's in it for themselves. The whole idea behind BFFC is to provide sort of this open source opportunity for everyone from farmers to processors to consumers to food truck operators, to use the resources that are there that are made available, to advance, their own economic vitality, but also really to advance the well-being of the community overall. I think we're at this point now where, our society, American society, we spent two or three generations either by default or, by action, really letting the intact food systems that were so important on a local and regional basis, we let them dissipate, disappear, in some cases be co-opted. I don't think it's ever been easy, for farmers in the United States, and particularly New England has all of its own constraints. But kind of in looking back, I think probably the biggest benefit people had that I'm afraid we're losing right now, is that agricultural community. One of my biggest concerns is kind of where this is all headed. Where are the young people, you know, who are able to step in? And, you know, do we want to encourage those young people to step in? We have to find ways to show them pathways forward. It used to be that was kind of a given. And it was either what you learned on the farm, or it was, you know, what happened, you know, in 4-H or FFA in the public schools, you know, or the county fairs. There were all kinds of ways to kind of pull people in. And, you know, now I think we've sort of lost some of the mechanisms and perhaps the enticements. We do a good job these days of providing kind of all the media glory of what it is to farm. But I think we need to find ways to back that up more, you know, with real economic viability, because it's tough. And so we're at this point now where we're really having to rebuild things. And so we start from what's most immediate, you know, what is local, and start to work on rebuilding that food system. And very often in rebuilding that food system, you know, it's something that, you know, surprises us sometimes. It's actually the middle of the food system that we really have to start rebuilding. It's that infrastructure. It's what happens between farm gate and dinner plate. And for a lot of good reasons, you know, we also have a stricter regulatory environment that sometimes is a really good thing in terms of food safety. In other cases, it's a one-size-fits-all scenario that makes it really, really difficult for farmers and processors to innovate and do things differently, try things out. It's just so expensive as soon as you start to get into infrastructure, especially when you start talking about stainless steel. The metal in the middle, you know, is sort of one of the biggest questions that we've got in front of us in figuring out how to make our way forward. And, you know, it's one thing to actually, you know, raise or grow a product, and then it's another to get it to the point of consumption. So it's not an easy route, and not in, you know, and very often a pretty expensive one too.
What does it look like for the Rutland kind of region or Southern Vermont? What would a more localized food web look like? What are the parts to that?
Yeah, well, obviously we need a vibrance in terms of the producers, the farmers, and folks who are doing value-added processing. It's really important that we make sure that, you know, we support farmers who are here, who are local. It's not the easiest way to make a living, that's for sure. I think we all know that. And then we also, you know, need the infrastructure that's in the middle that's often hidden. We need to make sure that for livestock, that we have processing facilities that are available. For value-added vegetables and fruits, we need to make sure that we have those processing things available. And then, you know, we need to make sure that with this agricultural economy, we keep, for example, tractor dealerships, heavy equipment dealerships, you know, in action. You know, those of us who are doing the farming and the production really rely on a number of people who are in the, you know, the trades in the service sector. And so, you know, and that's sort of what really builds out the resilience of it all, I think, in the end. And, you know, then we need to have those opportunities to come together in terms of the kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, perhaps, you know, the point of sale. We need to have, again, that vitality that's there and the exchange, you know, between farmers and consumers, and make sure that, you know, that's not only a great time for commerce and that kind of exchange, but that it's also this opportunity for exchanging ideas and understanding. And that's sort of where the agricultural literacy also starts to happen, which is so important in all of this.
So what role does a local food hub like Vermont Farmers Food Center play in that regional agricultural economy and maybe just regional economy at large?
Right. I think, you know, VFFC, you know, like so many food hubs, you know, they're in constant evolution, and there's a reason for that, because I think food hubs can be responsive to what the needs are in a community, in a region, and in a lot of cases step in and play a role that's not being played. And, you know, so the idea is not to compete with other entities that are out there, other businesses in particular, but really to support those businesses and to enhance the opportunities there. So with VFFC, it's just such an extraordinary opportunity to be able to do food processing there in-house, to have a gathering place, you know, a place where markets happen, education and training happen, that you start to get this nexus of people and ideas, and then also infrastructure. And, you know, so often when we're thinking about rebuilding local food systems, we forget about that middle. We forget about, that's the expensive part in so many ways. You know, it's a lot of stainless steel. It's a lot of equipment. There are things that, you know, the ordinary farmer or processor may not be able to afford. So, you know, I would say in a lot of ways, food hubs are incubators for good ideas. They step in, they take up the slack, they provide what's needed, they provide the opportunity for farmers and processors and others, you know, to get a leg up in the game. And that's just really what's so critical, because it's not easy. And, you know, just in terms of being able to really find your way and turn something that's food related, you know, into a viable economic activity. And so we really provide the support for doing that. You know, so many food hubs around the United States have not kind of, made it forward. They've failed after a couple of years, and certainly, you know, we don't want that to happen with VFFC. I'm left kind of ruminating at different times about what is it about VFFC, you know, that's potentially different. And sometimes I think that part of the difference is it's just had to be such a bootstrap effort from the very beginning. When you begin with very meager resources, you know, but very kind of, enriched dreams, you know, as Greg Cox and others have had, you know, from the very beginning, then that tension between, you know, the resources and the vision, I think can really put you in the right spot. And in a lot of cases, all the funding has come in one big swoop, you know, for a lot of food hubs. You know, in this case, it's happened piece by piece, step by step. And that is where the wisdom is really learned, is in making that, you know, slow, steady progression. And now things are accelerating, you know, as, you know, more funding has come in over the course of the last year or so. You know, so that just means that we've got to steward those resources very carefully. But I think we know at this point how to actually utilize those resources to maximize impact, because that's always what we're looking for. Maintaining our own viability, but then at the same time, also really making sure that all of what we do really maximizes impact for the community.
Tension between available resources and the vision for recreating a relational food web can create slow, stable, and resilient change. But tension between communities of people in a food web can increase inequality and erode trust. Ken Meter feels that the food system we have now creates wealth for some at the expense of others, but a relocalized community food web can be a vehicle for restoring trust and addressing injustice.
The more that we can engage people who've been marginalized, whether that's a person of color, whether that's a person who's low income, maybe it's a new immigrant who has farming skills but doesn't really know how to do business in our country. But the food system is a very great way to engage all those constituents in building something brand new. So we have people in various parts of New England, coming from Somalia, coming from Burma, coming from Ukraine now, who have incredible skills in the food system. Some know how to grow food very well. Some are good food processors. Some are good at being doctors or being other professionals. And if we can really engage, say, low-income communities in growing their own food, or engage immigrants in using the skills they have to create food for local people to eat, then we can create a more just society as well. And I'm kind of, you'll see I'm hinting at economics, but this is also about justice in the sense that land has been stolen from Native tribes. It's been held mostly by white people, and you know, if we build a good food system, it will have ownership opportunities for immigrants to own land even when it's expensive. It will have ownership opportunities for people to run food businesses. You know, negotiations are also important to justice, and that's again where the trust comes in. If you're building trust with people you didn't normally feel comfortable with, if you're building trust with people who live in a low-income area, if you're building trust between racial groups, then justice becomes much easier to pull off too.
On the next episode of Root Words, we'll take a closer look at the filaments that bind a community food web as we explore restoring relationships. This episode was produced by Stephen Abitel and Julia Anderson. Special thanks to Ellen Kaler, Ken Meter, and Philip Ackerman-Lest. To learn more about Ken Meter's work, check out Crossroads Resource Center at crcworks.org.
Our musical themes are by the Salt Ash Serenaders. We are a project of the Vermont Farmers Food Center and SAGE. Thank you all for listening and for being a part of our local food system. We'll catch you next time on Root Words.